Welcome, everyone, to this WebSphere Support
Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is troubleshooting a WebSphere Edge Load Balancer configured for NAT forwarding. Today's presenters are Harold Fanning and Marvin Knight. Harold's 32-year career spans several products like DPPX operating system, 17 years in development for communication server products, including OS2 and Windows. Since being in customer support, he has supported personal communications, host access transformation, the AST toolkit, IHS, WebSphere plugin, and WebSphere Edge products, including the load balancer and WAS community edition. Marvin has been with the IBM Corporation for 31 years. He is currently an advisory software engineer supporting the IBM HTTP server, HTTP plugin, and Edge components. Prior to that, he worked in ISPF development and support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Harold. Harold, you may begin.
Okay, thanks, David. Title page here, this presentation is about administering and troubleshooting the Edge load balancer with NAT forwarding. And the first few charts will probably compare NAT with MAC. So we go ahead and go to the next chart, page 2. This is the agenda. So what is load balancing? What is NAT forwarding versus what is MAC forwarding? We'll go through some terminology before we get into the charts to make it obvious what these things mean. And then I'm going to go through some of the setup commands that it takes to configure the load balancer for NAT forwarding, set up on the back-end servers, some of the rules that apply to that load balancing when you're doing NAT forwarding, as well as the back-end servers. And then we'll get into some of the must-gather and debugging techniques, tips and troubleshooting, and some of the simple network commands that are required to make sure you have it all configured and set up correctly. So move to slide 3. All right, this slide here, again, this presentation is about NAT, but I thought it was important to have a slide that did a little bit of a comparison between MAC forwarding or machine address forwarding versus the network address translation. So MAC forwarding is more efficient because it forwards packets at a MAC level, but it requires that the servers be within the same subnet, and it requires that the back-end servers be listening to a loopback, so there's a little bit more configuration to it. With NAT forwarding, we get rid of that restriction where that this back-end servers no longer have to be in the same subnet, and we have a return address and a cluster address that are used to forward the packets and for the servers to respond back, and the load balancer will maintain a translation table to accomplish that. We'll go to slide 4. So breaking down some of the terminology, load balancer itself has two different installable executables, and I put the first two bullets on this chart to talk about IPv4. The official name is IPv4, which means it's a kernel-based load balancer. And that means the code is kind of written as a device driver or down into the what we used to call below-the-line level of code, and it's tied into that operating system kernel module. IPv4 and IPv6 naming convention is what we term as user space load balancer, and this is now moves the load balancing function up into the user space and uses an API over to the operating system, and it's no longer dependent on the kernel version of the OS. Network forward address is used a lot in load balancing terminology because of the other addresses that we require. It's important to remember that the network forwarding address is the address of the machine as known to the host name or the DNS. If I were to look to say, you know, who is this Harold.com, the NFA is the address that's going to come back from the DNS. The cluster address is a virtual address that is defined it's defined to the same machine, but it's the address that the clients will use to hit the load balancer in order to be sprayed into one of the back-end servers. Return address is a forwarding address that the load balancer uses when he picks the server that he's decided to load balance or spray to, and that's the return address that the server knows as the face and will return to the return address back to the load balancer. This is where the network address translation table is maintained between the cluster and the return addresses. Load balancer also uses an advisor an advisor is a, sort of a health check, and we have several advisors that we offer as defaults, as well as the ability to roll your own advisor. And it uses the NFA, not the virtual IP, but it uses the network port address to send the packets back and forth to the health check of the back-end servers. High availability means that we can have a primary and a backup load balancer and do automatic failover and take-back in the event of keeping the high availability for your network, because this is going to be something that it's client-facing, so you don't want to lose connectivity. Go on to slide number 5, please. And when you install the load balancer, it's broken down to several components. And if you in the info center and the load balancer admin, it breaks down these components. So each component that is a function of the load balancer has separate responsibilities. So the executor function is actually the kernel code, the kernel piece that's doing all the actual spraying, you know, taking in packets and spraying them across. So that's the piece that does the balancing of TCP and UDP connections and packets. The manager is a component that sets up the weights and helps with the load balancer algorithm on how to choose and pick which back-end server to spray to. It's somewhat optional. If you don't run the manager, then you're going to just do a default round-robin type of assignment to the back-end servers. Advisor, we talked about. Advisor code is code that you might have a special requirement to, like in HTTP. If, for example, the advisor will send down a head request to make sure that there's somebody listening to HTTP requests that come in and make sure that it's still alive so we can keep it in the assignment of which load balancer to spray to. Metric server is, again, a system with specific metrics. If you were keeping track of your health check of your network, that's a separate installable. And the DS server is the component that actually handles the interface to the OS for your command line interface in order to support whatever that particular OS is. Move to slide 6. So this picture here is to help to go in before we get into the actual how we set this up. Picture here is trying to show that the individual clients are going to come in and hit that cluster address of the load balancer. So they're going to, and a lot of people will call that the virtual IP or the VIP. So they hit the cluster address, and that's all the client needs to know is I've hit this cluster address. That's where he thinks everything's being handled. The load balancer will then keep a table as a NAT translation table, and he'll switch the origin of the request to be from a return address. And then he'll pick which server to spray to and spray down to that particular server using the return address. And we can do that for any kind of protocol here like HTTP, FTP, SSL, LDAP. And that server then, its facing interface is going to be the return address. So when the server responds, he responds to the return address. Load balancer keeps track and says, okay, I know from the translation table that I have to send this request on back to the particular client that had come into the cluster. So that's the picture depicting what network address translation is all about. Please move to slide 7. So when you install the load balancer, it comes with a wizard, and the command to start up that wizard is the lbadmin command. So you can either configure it using the lbadmin command and the wizard. There's also command line support where you can issue individual command lines, DS control commands that are available and documented in the administration guide. The DS server command is the command that actually starts the load balancer. And then there's the DS control executor, which starts up that piece of code that's actually going to do the load balancing to the back-end servers. And then there's several DS control commands that will do define your network as far as what the cluster is, what the port is that cluster is actually working, you know, listening on or forwarding to, and the back-end servers have to be defined to the load balancer as well. And they can be, the back-end servers, of course, can scale up to how many servers belong to how many, to which cluster address, and I could then add many more cluster addresses and return addresses as it scales up. So the admin guide provides step-by-step instructions on some of this, and it's really helpful guide on how to step through it if you've never been through it before, on how to add one of these components at a time. It's The advisor itself is important. I put down here again, it's important to remember that the advisor is actually working on the network forwarding address and not the cluster address. And that can be a simple advisor that we provide with the product, or you can actually write your own advisor if you have a particular request response that you want to verify that server is something that can be sprayed to. We move on to page 8. So the load balancer NFA already spoke about is the network forwarding address that's required, that any machine will have when it's defined to the network. The cluster address is the client's target address that, again, we talk about that as being the virtual IP. The return address is the return address on the server side facing that he can come back to the load balancer to. There's a client gateway address, and this is so the load balancer knows how to get back to the client that made the request. There's the server router address, which is the router address to get down to the back-end servers, especially if they're in a different subnet. And there's the server address itself, so you know exactly which server you're going to. And I listed these on this page as all these addresses that you need to be concerned about before you go about setting up a load balancer, because they all must be static IPs. It's interesting just to mention that, because a lot of people will work with virtualization. Our policy for virtualization is that we can't really speak to a virtual adapter to know that it behaves exactly like a real adapter. So if the problem is reported on a virtual adapter, we need to have that recreated on real adapters to find out if it's really a problem or a problem with that virtualization software implementation of the adapter. Move on to slide 8-9. So this is sort of the same picture here, but I filled in some numbers for you for IP addresses, for example. And what I was trying to show here is that these, you notice I've purposely made this in colors and different subnets. So we don't have any control over where the client's coming from or what subnet he might come in through, but he's going to come in through a client gateway to the load balancer subnet. So I showed the client's gateway as being the 9.2.2.1. Just simple numbers. And the load balancer will receive from the client into that cluster address, the 9.2.2.3. And what he'll do is he'll take the request and send it down, and he sends it down through the router to the server, whichever server he picks. He has to know which router he has to go through to get to that server. So he will change it so that it goes out from the return address, send it through the router to the subnet of whichever back-end server that he picked. So in this case, I just changed it to a 9.3.3 subnet. And I scaled it up. Obviously, it wouldn't make any sense if you didn't have more than one server, so I put a couple of servers in there. So this is the picture that I use to then talk about the next slide, which uses the command. So if you could proceed to slide number 10. So these are what the DS control commands might look like if that was your network. And this is for the kernel-based load balancer. There is some difference in syntax to be aware of if you use the user space versus the kernel. But just to go through these commands, again, we did the DS server command. He's going to pick the DS server command is hard-coded to always use the default.config file. So as you scale this up and as you configure it, you probably want to make sure you have some sort of checkpoint where you save into the default config file or use some other scheme where you pick a config file that you load after you start. So in my case, I would probably have this in my default config file where the first thing I have to do is start the executor. And the executor is that piece of code that has to be there to do all the work. It's important to keep in mind, the executor runs whether your DS server is running or not, because the executor runs standalone. It doesn't need the API. But so it's important to notice that, because if you were to stop the DS server, that does not necessarily stop the executor that's running down in the in one case in the kernel, another case in the user space. So if you really want to stop the load balancer, you have to remember to use the DS control to stop the executor first, so it gets unloaded, and then stop the DS server so that the entire load balancer components are unloaded if, for example, you're putting on some kind of maintenance or whatever. So in this case, one of the first commands I have to do is I have to start that executor up to do the work for me. And then I want to do, I have to actually set the client gateway. And if you don't, it's important that you have to set the client gateway before you do any of the other runtime activities, because he needs to have that client gateway to understand that it's okay to configure a NAT configuration or NAT network address translation. So I set the client gateway, and then this first executor configure, if you remember my picture, the .9.2.2.3 command IP was the IP that I used for my cluster address. So I have to define that cluster address, and then I can set the cluster address to some sort of starting proportions. And this is really just a starting of a weight to know how to spray to the back-end servers. That'll all be manipulated once runtime gets going and your advisor and your manager all take over. So then after I have a cluster IP address, I have to probably have them listen to a particular port. So then I would add the port. In this case, it's just a simple port 80. And on that define of the port is where I tell them I'm going to do a method forwarding of NAT. The default method forwarding is MAC. So if you don't say the method here, it'll be a MAC forwarding environment. And then I added a, you can do some set commands to tell the port, to tell the cluster on that port how to behave. Stale timeout is something that's used for things like affinity to make sure that you have a client always routed to the same backend server for a certain amount of time. And then once I have that, this next executor configure command, the .9.2.2.4 IP address is what I use for my return address. So that, again, belongs to me as a load balancer. So I have to define that to the network, to my server. And then once I have that return address, now I can do the I can define the actual backend servers. And I did the two different backend servers. The syntax here is to have the add command with the cluster IP first, because, again, if you scale it up, I could have several clusters. So I need to have the cluster IP. The port, I could have several ports. So you could scale this up as well, but in this case, it's just I have the one cluster address and the one port 80, and then I define the router address itself. Now, that's the real router address. I'm sorry, that's the real backend server address. And to get to that backend server address, I need to know which router I use to go through that. So then I have the router address. And now I have to tell that server which return address I want him to come back to, and that's what I'll use as my facing IP when I send the request on down to that server. And then these last couple commands are where I start the manager and I start the advisor. And in this case, I used the default HTTP for port 80 advisor that's part of the product and part of the install. And my note at the bottom of this page is to note that this is a default config file. But the default config file is just at startup time, and I can do runtime commands all along the way while my load balancer is running, which will affect what might have been in the original default or what I've added to my network as I do runtime. So it's more important to probably gather the server.log, where you actually see not only what was loaded with the original configure, but also what might have been added with command line as the runtime moved on. So server.log will echo anything that comes in on the config as well as any runtime commands that have been issued after that. And again, keep in mind that this syntax here is to show that it's in a kernel or IPv4 example. And in ULB or IPv4 and IPv6, there's some syntax differences, things like the port, instead of using a colon, it uses an at sign. So the syntax is different between the two installable load balancers. So now we can go to slide 11. So this is a chart I put out there now for the decision making process of whether I'm going to use MAC forwarding or NAT forwarding. So one of the things with MAC forwarding, if I know all my servers are in the same subnet, I could probably get away with a simple MAC forwarding type of configuration. But if I have backend servers that are not in the same subnet, I might want to. I have no choice but to use NAT forwarding. And the server applications in MAC forwarding have a requirement of listening to both the NFA and the cluster, of their own NFA and the cluster, so that we can forward back on the MAC forward to the cluster. And when you go to NAT forwarding, the server no longer has that requirement. So there's no changes required at the NAT forwarding at all, because he's going to just get a request in from that return address and respond to that return address. Proceed to slide 12. So again, for the load balancer to work, everything must be a static IP, because everything is statically configured and hard-coded. You can't learn what the IP address is. For the load balancer's NFA, for the cluster address that's used, for the return address, and the back-end servers all have to have static addresses. in order to determine, there's some system commands you can use to determine who the client gateway is. There's a display route command, and you also have some system commands to define who the router is that to get to your server. You know, if you do a display route, and the first hop to that router address would be the server router. We have an example of that in a later chart. The return address itself cannot be modified on the server in runtime. You'd have to actually remove the server and reconfigure the server with a new return address if you change that return address. So, you know, if the customer were to say, gee, I changed this and it doesn't take effect, that's because he has to go back to the startup and define it with the new address. Client gateway must be configured before you can configure any NAT forwarding. And if the back-end server is in the same subnet as the load balancer machine, then his router could be his own IP address. You don't need to go through the overhead of skipping through the router because he's in the same subnet. Chart 13. This is another chart reminding you that the client gateway parameter, it has to be defined with the DS control executor set command before you... If you don't do this before you actually get into the configuration, he won't even allow the method forwarding type of NAT. So you want to set that client gateway parameter in the DS control executor set in the beginning of your load balancer configuration. And that the client gateway is the IP address that's used to find your way back to the client so that the load balancer can go back. Okay, proceed to slide 14. And actually, this is embarrassing. I didn't realize this until I was reviewing the charts last night. This is the same as slide 12, so we can go skip right past this and go to slide 15. We'll correct that in the deck before we get it published. So here are some of the system commands that you would use to make sure that you have your load balancer set up and configured correctly. The load balancer has a logs directory, and in that logs directory is where these things are, like the server log, advisor log, and all those logs for those components we talked about. Packet tracing is used a lot for load balancers, and Marvin has some examples of packet tracing to show us in the end of this presentation. Because we're dealing with packet forwarding, that's probably the best thing to do is get a packet trace at the load balancer, show what comes in, show what the load balancer sends back out. Load balancer also has several reports. You could do a DS control command to issue the executor report to tell the health of your system. There's a manager report. There's a server report. So we might ask the customer to do some of these reports to verify that everything's up and running like they think it is. There's some network commands to prove that the load balancer and the backend servers are listening and configured the way they should be. Things like netstat an, ipconfig-all, and of course whether you're Windows or Linux-based, ifconfig-a, to show what's been configured to that load balancer adapter. And display route, we already talked about, we use that to find out how we're going to get to either the client or the server, and I think we have some examples of that later as well. So you can go proceed to slide 16. So this is the output of an ipconfig-all. So I just kind of showing you, if you're not familiar with what you normally see, where you see the physical address or the MAC address in here as well as the IP address. And in MAC forwarding, you would want to pay attention to the physical address. And with NAT forwarding, you're only concerned with the IP address. But I wanted to show here in this example that because the load balancer has hijacked the cluster address and the return address, they don't show up to the operating system interface. So I wanted to show that you'll notice that there's no cluster address or return address in the ipconfig output. And if there is, that's a problem. That's a red flag that somebody's configured it incorrectly. It shouldn't be there. It should only be configured through the load balancer runtime. Proceed to slide 17. So this is another example that I had Marvin do, ipconfig all. One was done on a ULB. One was done on a kernel LB. I just wanted to show you that you're going to get the same kind of output where you have the NFA reported only in the ipconfig output. Proceed to slide 18. And this is a little exercise we put in here to prove who owns those addresses, because sometimes the addresses will be added or maybe migrated from a previous environment where they belong to some other server. So ping is a good example on how to do that. You will ping the cluster address. And, of course, in this case with NAT, you also have a return address. you'll want to ping the return address. And after you get the response to the ping, you know, someone's going to respond to the ping, you're going to want to do an ARP minus A and then prove that that MAC address that belonged to your load balancer is the guy that owned those two addresses. If it's not, it's another red flag. Go find out who owns those addresses, because only the load balancer can own those addresses. Go ahead and proceed to page 19. So this is just a picture of the same sort of thing on why I would ping to find out who owns the address. So from my load balancer, I would want to ping. If I have some sort of connectivity problem with my web servers, from the load balancer, I want to ping and make sure I can actually get to those load balancers. And you know, a lot of network type debugging is done here to make sure that you can get to the address, to the load balancer, down to the server addresses and back. And I think Marv is going to talk about that as well. If you have any other edge devices that might be interfering with that, they need to be open to the multiple addresses involved in the load balancer. From those boxes themselves, you really need an external client, which is why I drew that as an external client, because if I were to ping from my load balancer where I own the same address, that's really not going to be an accurate test. So I want from some other machine to ping the address and see what the MAC address is that comes back. And I want to do that from the same subnet so I don't have any router in the way, so that I can actually verify the MAC address that the load balancer owns the cluster address and the return address. Go to slide 20. So these are, again, some of the simple network commands that can be used to verify the routing tables, the netstat-nr for the routing table, to make sure that there's no additional bad routes in the routing table based on maybe some previous setup or maybe some migration from what used to be MAC into a NAT forwarding. And there's netstat-an to see all the bindings that are done within the load balancer and the back-end servers to make sure that they're listening to the right addresses. Display route to find out if you get the right router to get to the to either the client or the server itself. And a reminder here that stopping the load balancer server with a DS server stop does not stop the executor. So make sure the executor is stopped before you stop the server. Proceed to slide 21. This is a screen capture of what a route print might look at like if you were trying to find the client gateway. What you notice in the gateway column, there's an IP address of who that gateway is out to the clients. And this is something we'd want to do before we actually get into configuration, so we make sure we have a valid gateway address to configure for the client gateway. Proceed to slide 22. Slide 22 is a picture of the output from a traceroute command in Windows. In traceroute, this is what you might do when you say, okay, I want to know how I got to the back-end server. So I punch in the back-end server's IP, look at the first hop in my traceroute, and that would be the router to the other subnet where the back-end server might be. Proceed to slide 23. And slide 23 is the output of the netstat-an, where I want to prove that he's listening. In this case, my load balancer was monitoring port 80. I just want to make sure that he is, in fact, listening on port 80. So I would do the netstat-an to see who's listening. So at this point in the presentation, I'd like to turn it over to Marvin Knight, and we can go ahead and proceed to slide 24.
Thanks, Harold. One of the key things we like to obtain in debugging load balancer problems is an IP trace. You can get IP traces using TCP dump, IP trace, Snoop, etc. The main thing is we like to get a trace of the entire data flow, so we don't typically like to filter the trace with the IP trace command itself or the TCP dump command, but get the entire thing and get it in a binary format. Once we have that data, we then use a tool called Wireshark to look at the traces, and at that point we'll filter out the data. What I've listed here is the three main filters that we use when we're looking at these traces. Now, in this particular case, I'm using a situation where the client IP is 9.27.163.128. The cluster IP is 9.27.162.82. The return address is 9.27.162.83, and the backend server is 9.42.129.126. And you'll see these IPs in the next few charts on the Wireshark screens. The first basic filter we like to use is tcp.port equal NN, where NN is a port number, typically 80. And within parentheses, the ip.adder equal the cluster IP or the ip.adder equal return address. What that filter will do is give you the complete flow of the cluster and the traffic going to the backend server from the load balancer. Below that is the example using the IPs I mentioned. The second filter would be just tcp.port equal NN and the ip.adder equal cluster IP. That would give you the flow from the client to the load balancer. Third filter, tcp.port equal NN and ip.adder equal the return address. That's your flow from the load balancer to the backend server. Screen full 25, please. Here you can see this is an actual Wireshark run with the filter put in for the entire data flow. When you look at the output on the side under the info column, you can see everything looks like it's repeated twice. That's because you've got the client coming into the load balancer, and then the load balancer turns around and forwards that same traffic to the back-end server. So you seem to see everything in duplicate just looking at that. Page 26, please. To summarize that last chart, you've got the client hits a load balancer, then the load balancer would send the request via the return address to the back-end server. That third bullet should say the back-end then responds back to the return address, and then the load balancer sends a response back to the client. Full 27. Also, the top line should say packet trace is showing the client traffic to the back-end load balancer. So what you have here looks more like normal data flow if you were to just do a basic IP trace on a server. You're just seeing the connection come in, the acknowledgement, the request, and then the response. Now, that would just be the request coming into the load balancer. Next full, 28, and that summarizes what we just looked at. You've got the load balancer receives the request from the client. You then have the client IP to the cluster IP, and then the cluster IP responds back to the client IP. So that's the only thing you would see just using that filter. Now, thing to note on that is the client never sees the back-end server or the return address. To him, it's just as though he's talking to the cluster. 28, please. Now, here we have the packet trace showing the back-end traffic, and you can see the filter in the filter column. Now, one of the things to note here is you not only see the traffic going to the back-end server with the actual request that the client sent, you're also seeing advisor traffic using this filter. The very top line of this screen, you can see a head request. That head request is the default advisor request from the load balancer for HTTP traffic. As Harold mentioned earlier, that could be modified with an advisor request, advisor response type parameter on the server add. For instance, you might have a web server on your back end that then talks to WebSphere. You might want to issue some type of GET request to a JSP and then specifically check for certain values to make sure that not only is the web server healthy, but the back-end application is healthy. So that's where you might use an actual advisor request, and we would utilize the IP traces to make sure the request is going and getting the response back correctly. Now, further down on that same page, you'll see the GET slash. That's the actual request for the cluster. And you can see that the return address is what's sending the request to the back-end server. The back-end server responds back to the return address. Page 30, please. So this is summarizing that. You've got the advisor traffic where you see the NFA, or the non-forwarding address, being used to send to the back-end server IP, and then the return address is being used to send the actual request to the back-end server. Note here, the cluster IP is never seen by the back-end server, which is why Harold said earlier, there's no adjustment needed on the back-end servers with loopbacks or anything of that sort. It can just be configured as it was before, and most of the configuration is just done on the load balancer as a result. Page 31. Now, the other key point to take out of this, using those IP traces, you can see that the only thing going to the back-end server is the NFA address is used to go there and the return address. So when you're looking at your firewalls, the firewall has to accept traffic from those two IPs, not the cluster IP. The cluster IP is never seen by the firewall. That's a fairly common mistake that we see, and one of the number one problems or answers that we respond back with is firewall issues, and they've opened it up to the wrong thing. They open it up to the cluster IP instead of the return address and the NFA. Page 32, please. As of 8.5.5, the user space code, the IPv4 and IPv6, now supports NAT. Up until this point, NAT has not been supported by user space. A key difference with the way the NAT support is implemented in ULB is that it's done at the server level, not the port level. So what you would see is a DS control server command where there's now a NAT parameter to specify that that particular server is done via NAT. Now, one of the things that this allows you to do is you could actually mix NAT and MAC. Another key point with the user space is that MAP port is not supported in the user space code. If you need to use MAP port, and MAP port would be where you come in on port 80, say, and then go to a different port on the back-end server, such as 88. That is not done with the user space code. You would still have to use the IPv4 code or the kernel code to do MAP port if you need that. And finally, the affinity algorithms with the user space with NAT, it only supports connection and connection plus affinity. And then below that is the example of the actual server add for the IPs that I was using in the prior examples. All right, page 33, please. To summarize, these are some additional resources that deal with what we've been speaking about. The load balancer must gather tech note. There's the second one is a troubleshooting tech note for load balancer. Then there's the Edge Info Center, and one of the most valuable pieces of documentation you can get from that would be the admin guide. Whether you're using user space or the kernel, there is a ton of information in the admin guide, and quite often the answer you're looking for is there if it would actually have been searched first. And at this point, I think we can turn it back over to David.
Thank you, Harold and Marvin, for a great presentation. At this time, we would like to open the lines for questions.
At this time, there are no questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Harold and Marvin, for presenting today.
Welcome.